Zainab, welcome to Waterstones.
Thank you so much, Will. It's great to be with you.
I'm very, very intrigued to talk to you about this book because having read it from cover to cover, I have discovered that my ignorance about African history is almost total. You do make the point that, of course, for most people at school, there will be that period where you're definitely taught about ancient Egypt, and we can all remember quite a lot of that. But even that history is told through a Western lens. And you were really keen to make sure that you were telling a history of a whole continent. Can you remember the moment when you thought, I have to do this?
A series of moments, really, that prompted me. And actually, the surprising thing is it was a recurrence of a moment. Because in my travels around Africa to around 34 countries, I spoke to dozens and dozens of African academics. And every single one, the situation was replicated. In this way, I would arrive late because the traffic was often bad, but they were all so gracious and so keen to talk to me that they didn't utter a word of complaint. All the same, I had to tear myself away from them at the end of the interview. They just wished to carry on talking to me about their subject. And that was the same everywhere I went. And also, at the end of each session, with an academic, I had a couple of locals with me. They all said, you know, gosh, that went on for a long time, but thank you so much, Zainab, because we've learned so much about our own history that we didn't know, and we're so impressed by these people. So It was a series of moments right across the continent that made me think, these intellectuals, African intellectuals, want a stage. Their voice has not been heard globally. And so that's what prompted me to write this book. And also, it all culminated with an interview I conducted at the University of Lusaka in Zambia, where I said to this particular historian, I'd love to talk to you outside, not in your office, because it's a bit dark. And he closed his office door with so many keys, it was as though it was Fort Knox. And I looked at the room that, you know, before we left as he was closing it, and it was just piled high with documents and books and his writings, his scribblings. It was gold to him. To anybody else, you'd look at it and you'd think, oh, this is just a mess. But it was so valuable to him, a lifetime of work, that he had to lock it in this way because he thought, you know, don't want anybody to steal it.
Yeah.
So that, honestly, Will, is what made me think I felt duty-bound to ensure that their voices and their perspectives of their own history, of their own country, was heard.
I mentioned Egypt, and obviously it is the one part of African history that is almost certainly taught in most schools. But you point out in the book that, of course, Egyptian history, Egyptian archaeology is funded and supported and has been a bit of a bully actually across the rest of Africa in terms of people's attention, so that the neighbouring countries certainly, but actually the whole continent struggles to get that kind of attention.
Completely. I mean, first of all, a lot of people don't even put Egypt in Africa.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll say, they go to other parts of Africa and they'll say, oh, well, this rivals anything that you might find in Egypt. Well, like, hang on, Egypt is part of Africa. So In writing the chapter in the way I did, I wanted to challenge people's perceptions that Egypt is not part of Africa. That what you need to do is challenge your perceptions of what being an African is. And so that was very important for me to point out in the chapter. And yes, as a result of, you know, Napoleon's men discovering the Rosetta Stone and essentially sort of establishing the West's fascination with Egyptology, it did become the domain of Egyptologists who were, for the most part, not Egyptian. I don't want to sound churlish about that because, you know, there's been some great work done by Egyptologists and a lot of, you know, deciphering of hieroglyphics and so on, and that's wonderful. But it is even more wonderful, in my opinion, now that we have got leading Egyptologists in their fields who are Egyptian. Because throughout the book, a very important aspect of telling this history of Africa is that I feel it's important to give people the courtesy and the respect of telling their own story. I mean, how funny would it be if we all applauded a history of England by some, you know, French historian or whatever, I mean, you know, it might strike you as a bit odd. And if you think about all our celebrated historians of English history, they are English.
Culturally as well, I was thinking it was, you know, I was going to say a character there, but it's not a character, it's a real person. You know, Cleopatra, of course, we sort of receive this wisdom from something like the Shakespearean representation of that person and think that we know who she was and what she was like. But as you point out in the book, you're actually looking at a canny politician, quite a fearsome military ruler, not Elizabeth Taylor in her sort of finery, you know, sort of a very, very different woman, very different ruler.
Completely. I mean, extremely clever, an intellectual who loved to surround herself with scholars, advance their, you know, studies and their work. And that was brought home to me by the Egyptian historian I walked around Alexandria with at Alexandria University, Bahir Shaheen. And she, you know, was just telling me how this is how she and other Egyptian historians see Cleopatra, not as the exoticization of her that we have in the West. It is totally at odds with how she is perceived there. I mean, I have to say the Ptolemies were really a very violent lot amongst themselves. I mean, they made internecine warfare look like a picnic. I mean, they really were, you know, going at one another hammer and tong, including Cleopatra. And as I said, she was suspected of being involved in the killing of her brother king. And so, you know, I hope I don't look at her through rose-tinted spectacles, but look at her, I think, you know, more accurately than the Western depiction is. And that's mostly derived from the writings of Roman scholars.
And as you point out in the book, even the word Africa itself comes from the Roman Ifriqiya.
Ifriqiya, yeah. I know, I said I've sort of felt quite ambivalent about this in the book because I do love the word Africa. I think it's such a wonderful, you know, evocative word. But yes, it was the name for the North African provinces of the Romans. They called it Ifriqiya, and after they defeated Carthage. So it applied initially to Tunisia. So the Tunisian historians I spoke to said, yeah, we're very glad that actually we have bequeathed this name to the whole of the continent. It was given to us, but we've given it to the rest of the continent, as it were. So, I mean, yes, it is. And I think that, you know, when you think about that, nobody wants to change the name Africa anymore. But I mean, if you see what's happened in Southern Africa, how, you know, the names of imperialists have been changed and Africanized and so on, then it's like, you know, Jan Smuts Airport in South Africa becomes Oliver Tambo International and so on. And I think that's quite right.
Looking at your sort of, I suppose, your personal family history, it must have been fascinating to go to the Sudan and to get more of that information from the archaeologists and the historians there. Were there any things that particularly leapt out that you were sort of thrilled to include in the book?
Yeah, I think that I'd always, because, I mean, you know, I did postgraduate studies in history, and we were always told that history, you know, it informs our present, but it also, it tells us about our past, it informs our present, but also helps shape the future, and history is alive. And I think that's the thing that struck me most about when I went to Sudan and talked to people there, is that my grandmother, who was born at the turn of the last century, my grandfather, her husband, who was born at the end of the 19th century, I remembered vaguely their home. I mean, I left Sudan when I was barely 3 years of age, but I went back on holidays there. And some of the things that they had in their homes and the way my grandmother dressed, and I'm named after her, so I have a particular attachment to her, was very much like the ancient Kushites, whom I focus on in the chapter about ancient Sudan, you know, around the 8th century, 7th, 8th century BCE. And so that continuity of history is what struck me the most. And also the fact that my father told me then he comes from the far north of Sudan going towards the border with Egypt, how when he was a little boy, when a child was born, including him probably, they'd be taken to the River Nile to have some water put on their forehead in a kind of, you know, reminiscent of a baptism, because of course that part of Sudan was centuries ago Christian, with the Nubian Christian kingdoms. So I think that's what I liked about that chapter, was the living history aspect of it, and you know, how it was redolent of the past. And also I remarked on a little fact, which is the ancient Sudanese, the Kushites from northern Sudan, didn't eat fish. They thought it was an abomination to eat it, perhaps because of its rotting qualities. And I have a brother who doesn't eat fish. I have other relatives who don't eat fish. And the northern Sudanese consumption of fish is extremely low compared to Egypt, for instance. And so, you know, that's very interesting. You think, why? Because there are two River Niles in Sudan, yeah, and it runs more through Sudan than it does Egypt. So, again, you know, it's just wonderful to see how something that, you know, you can't just relegate history to the past. So I think that's what I found the most striking. But also the kings of Kush in the 7th and 8th century BCE. I mean, such a, you know, fascinating story. They were a regional superpower in Asia. You know, they protected the princes of Byblos and Tyre, you know, modern day Lebanon, and took on the Assyrian army and defeated them on several occasions. And one of their kings is mentioned in the Bible. And, you know, and a Kushite, Moses, the prophet Moses, married a Kushite. There's just so much history there that's little told.
With the proximity of Egypt, that quite often the cultural achievements of the neighbouring countries would be sort of, well, the Egyptologists would like to sort of say it was the influence of Egyptian culture that was the reason for those buildings or those, you know, paintings. Exactly. And as you say, it is, it's really important to point out that they had their own cultures, their own strengths, and that those were independent of Egypt.
Completely. I mean, Dr. Shadia Taha, who is a renowned Sudanese archaeologist, historian, is really at great pains, and I quoted her in the book, to say how, you know, a lot of Egyptologists and historians and archaeologists try to see ancient Sudan in this period and that region as derived from ancient Egypt. I mean, there are similarities for sure, but ancient Sudan, particularly in its first iteration, Napata, you know, predates ancient Greece, Rome, and you know, she says quite clearly that actually the enamelling of pottery, which we see in ancient Egypt, she says actually it was the Kushites who did that first. So she talks about the cross-fertilization. It isn't just ancient Egypt giving something to the Sudanese. So I think that's very important, that you know, transfer of ideas and knowledge. It's clear that Sudan wasn't just the junior partner. I know you'd probably think, she would say that. And I'm sure the Egyptians thinking, well, she would say that. But, you know, that's certainly... and, you know, there's Apedimak, the lion god, who's very different, a deity that the Egyptians didn't have. And the Sudanese have their own hieroglyphics, admittedly a bit later than the ancient Egyptian ones. But I think that it's important to see a region's history. I mean, I can't really say countries because there weren't countries as such then. There was Egypt, I suppose, but, you know, most African countries were really formed in the 19th century. But I think it's important to see every region, every country's history through its own lens. This is really very important, and that's, you know, the backbone of my book.
And it's hugely often attached to the cultural remnants, I suppose, of that history. So that one of the fascinating chapters for me was about Benin. Again, as you say, this is not the modern nation of Benin that we know now, but this was a different region. And the Benin bronzes, can you tell us a little bit about what those are, why they're so fantastic, and that will lead us into this sort of talk about cultural artefacts?
Yeah, I mean, the Benin bronzes, and as you say quite rightly, it's not the Republic of Benin, Dahomey, as it used to be known, but southern Nigeria. And wonderful, wonderful historian I spoke to there, Professor Osalador, who had studied, funnily enough, got his PhD from Bonn University in Germany. So he talked me through these, and also the wonderful director at the Benin National Museum. So the Benin bronzes really started around the 1200s when there was a cast, a bronze casters guild, which was started by the Oba of Benin. That's the name of the king, Oba, the Oba. And they use a method called the lost wax method. And, you know, you've probably seen these bronzes, which funnily enough are often not made of bronze, but other metals, but there we go. And sometimes made of terracotta. And they would be bronze heads or sort of like plaques on walls where you would see pictures of the Oba, but they're more than just art for art's sake. They also relate history. You know, they're the custodians of Benin's history, so they would depict a battle there or Portuguese soldiers visiting the court in Benin City in the 1400s, for instance. So it was started, as I said, in the 1200s, this guild of bronze casters, and that it continues to this modern day. And why they became so famous is that when the British troops ransacked and destroyed the royal city of Benin in the 19th century, late 19th century, they took a large number of these bronzes with them, and only a few have remained in Benin City. So when I visited the Oba, the king, I said to him, you know, you obviously want these back. And he said, yes, we would. We'd like some to stay out there in the West and North America, because we want people to know about, you know, our kingdom. And so that's one way. They're sort of, he saw them as kind of inanimate ambassadors.
Yeah. This is what I found fascinating, because the discussion about the restitution of cultural artifacts is, you know, constant and ongoing. And I think a lot of people would assume that African nations would like their stuff back. But actually, as he said, that there is a diplomatic reason for some of them to remain out there in the world, to have that knowledge in other countries, to celebrate the culture of Benin and other countries, is an incredibly important part of what they can
completely.
Do.
And that's what Oba, you know, Owari II said to me, and he's very keenly aware of this, because he's a former Nigerian, because obviously Benin is now part of Nigeria, and former Nigerian ambassador to Italy, so, you know, country bulging with cultural stuff. So he's aware of the kind of, you know, cultural diplomacy. But there has to be a balance, because a landmark report that was commissioned by the French government in, I think, around 2017, a few years ago, said that at least 90%, possibly 95% of African art and treasures is held outside of the continent.
Yeah.
And that's probably a bit too excessive. Yeah. You want some stuff to stay outside, but not the vast majority.
Yeah.
And I went to so many museums right across Africa. Every country I visited, I would go to their national museums, and also museums in, you know, provincial museums. And some of the exhibits, it's pathetic. They have hardly anything.
Yeah.
And even the one in actually Benin City is an excellent one and really beautifully curated. But they have replicas.
Right.
Replicas of things like the famous Idia, bust of Idia, which is a queen of Benin, and queen mother of Benin, rather. The real one is in the British Museum. So, so I think there's an argument for keeping some of the stuff out, but there is an argument for having quite a lot more put back in Africa. And there's always this argument, oh, they won't look after it properly, and we look after it properly, and then they've got, you know, terror attacks in some parts of Africa and so on. I think that everything has to be done on a case-by-case study.
I think with the recent news story about things going missing from the British Museum, you'd have to be a bit careful about...
I think that's very true, Will, very true.
And sort of one of this thing about the cultural changes, or rather sort of the changes in countries, as you say, they weren't countries quite early on in their histories, and not the states that we know today. And this is partly to do with, I suppose, Western nations coming in and drawing these slightly arbitrary lines on the map in order to create nations. And I didn't realise, I think, quite how widespread that was, because you keep saying again and again through the book, nope, this isn't the country that you think you know, this is a different, you know, different part of the continent. This, of course, relates to the other impact that Western society had on Africa, which is, of course, the slave trade, arbitrary divisions that would separate cultures, but also put together people who didn't have any connection, and you would play on that sort of divide and conquer tactic in order to... But you do point out that there is a big difference between the Indian Ocean slave trade and the transatlantic slave trade, and that there's, I guess, a different legacy for both of those. Would you mind if we just sort of touch on that quickly, sort of to look at why that's important in Africa's history?
Yeah, so, I mean, sometimes it's referred to as the Arab slave trade, the Indian Ocean slave trade, but I don't think that's correct to say, and that's why I say Indian Ocean slave trade, because one is a geography, the transatlantic slave trade, you never hear it referred to as the European slave trade or the North American slave trade. So I think we need to get the terminology right, which is why I say the Indian Ocean slave trade, although, of course, the Arabs did also trade across the Sahara mm-hmm. when North Africa became Arabized, and they also had some trade across the Red Sea. But the vast majority of enslaved people went across the Indian Ocean. So, I mean, there were differences. The Indian Ocean slave trade started much earlier, possibly as early as the 7th century, 8th century certainly, and it lasted longer till the 19th century, late 19th century. The transatlantic slave trade started around 1510 with the Portuguese and the Spanish acquiring enslaved people for South America. But the chattel slavery of the transatlantic slave trade was quite different from the Indian Ocean slave trade in the sense that the enslaved Africans were needed to work on plantations, often backbreaking work on the sugar plantations in the Caribbean, in the New World, as it were. Some were employed in domestically as domestic servants. In the Indian Ocean slave trade, they did go to work, but obviously there wasn't as much agricultural land in the Arab world as it was then. But they worked in the salt marshes of Mesopotamia, which would be modern-day Iraq, horrible work. They'd work as pearl divers, going, you know, really deep down undersea. They often became deaf and so on. But they also had the opportunity to work as soldiers, as scribes, as artisans, eunuchs in harems. I mean, that wasn't great because they would be castrated. And that was a horrible operation that very few survived, in fact. But so there were differences in the sense that there were more avenues of employment, as it were, for enslaved Africans in the Indian Ocean slave trade. But one crucial difference is if an Arab man had sexual relations, normally probably against the woman's will, but if a child resulted from that, then that child would be born free, and in practice the mother would also be free to look after the child, whereas in the transatlantic slave trade, if a white man sired a child with an enslaved African woman, that child would also be born a slave. And there are, you know, accounts of white men putting to work their own flesh and blood in the field, you know. So that's a very critical difference between the two.
You make the point that sort of for Africans looking at their own history, that there has been this reticence for some to actually confront the legacy of the slave trade, the complicity for some communities or cultures that were involved in it. But the conversation is happening. And there is, of course, as well, that conversation about reparations, which, of course, I'm sure Western nations are too scared to have as well. It feels like it's something that is still far from resolved for both Africans and those who were enslaving them.
I think it's happening. I mean, the issue of reparations, I think it is happening. It's happening in a fairly sort of silent way. It's not a kind of, da-da, here we are, the world is going to give all the descendants of enslaved Africans reparations. On Monday morning, here's your bag of money. No, it's not working like that. But what you find, for instance, even in the United Kingdom, the Church of England discovered that its more than $10 billion fund has benefited from the proceeds of slavery from the early 1700s. From money, you know, bestowed on them by the royal family. So the Church of England, for example, has set up a fund of £100 million and is asking institutions, corporations, families that have benefited from the transatlantic slave trade to contribute to this fund, and they will use it to invest in black British businesses, for instance, or community enterprises and so on. So that is something that's happened. You've seen some families that have benefited from the transatlantic slave trade, like the Trevelyan family. You know, my former colleague at the BBC, Laura Trevelyan, has made this now her work to try and find a way, because her family benefited from slave ownership in the Caribbean, to you know, have some form of restitution. So I think it is happening, and you've seen, you know, corporations and councils and various entities saying we want to, you know, make amends. And you're seeing expressions of regret about, you know, enslavement and so on. So I think it's happening by stealth. and even the United States in the Congress, there have been debates about this. I think the problem is people don't understand, perhaps, there isn't a clear definition of what reparations are. I mean, the German government gave some money, which really is reparations, to a couple of communities in Namibia, the Herero and Namqua people, because of atrocities that were committed against them in the early 20th century by the Germans. I mean, that is, you know, reparations, because, but it's in the form of development aid for health and education projects. It's not for individuals. But there are some voices in the United States that say reparations should go to individual families regardless of their wealth. So even, you know, Oprah Winfrey or Michael Jordan should be the recipient of reparations. And most people would say that strikes them as quite absurd.
Yeah. In recent years, there has been a lot of work within Western history to sort of redress the balance across the gender divide, so that trying to tell the stories of more women through history. And you're really careful in this book as well to point out that women have always been a hugely important part of African history. These amazing African heroines, I would sort of call them, these fantastic queens and important stateswomen. Are there any that sort of jump out to you to sort of mention now as being ones that you were fascinated by?
I mean, really, you've got to hand it to Queen Njinga, albeit she was active in providing the Portuguese with enslaved people. I have to say that as a strong caveat, because often African elites, or quite a few African elites, did do that. But she really was a remarkable woman who lived a very, you know, interesting life in the 17th century. So she's somebody who, I mean, you know, when I went to Luanda, the capital of Angola, and saw this huge statue to her, you just think, yeah, she really was a towering presence. I mean, she was very feisty and really stood up to the Portuguese for a long time. And also Kimpa Vita, also early 18th century in the what was then the Kingdom of Congo, which would be Angola and the Congo, DRC today. A kind of Joan of Arc figure whose Christian movement is still influential today. But I think there's also just, you know, the unnamed women. I remember in Ghana talking to Samia Nkrumah, the daughter of Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of independent Ghana, just saying to me, you know, her father really always talked to her about the fact that there were so many women who supported his nationalist movement for independence. And, you know, and what we were discussing about what a shame it is that we talk about the fathers of independence. And you go to Freedom Park in Lagos in Nigeria, for example, and you go to Freedom Park and there are all these, you know, the men, the fathers, Herbert Macaulay and so on. All the I mean, I'm not saying that they're not important, but, you know, there were women too. So at this point it was brought home to me by a wonderful woman academic I met in Congo Brazzaville. And she was saying to me how it's very important that we acknowledge women's role in history. And I think this is something which resonates with everybody all over the world. You know, we have to make sure that history is feminized. And I try to do that where I could. Queen Kahina, you know, who fought the Arabs in North Africa. She was a Berber queen, very against Arab domination. And, you know, went into battle, hair flowing, you know, against them. So I think that where I can, it's important to include women's contribution to history.
You end the book, which has obviously been looking back by looking to the future, and some of the things that we've spoken about you see as being crucial to that, with each individual country able to celebrate its culture and history, it should lead to a stronger continent. What do you think will be the crucial things in the coming years and decades?
I think that, and it may sound a bit cliche to say it, but, you know, as a mother of four children, I see the zest of youth and, you know, the hunger for achievement and, you know, wanting to do something and wanting to create a life of meaning and purpose, as well as also just supporting themselves. And that, I think, is, for me, the most important thing about Africa is its youth. And, you know, as I say, youth are active. And when you think the average age in Africa is about 18 or 19, in the United Kingdom it's about 44, in Japan it's 49, in France it's 46. You know, by 2040, a quarter of the world's population its consumers, its producers, its workers are going to be African, and by 2100 it could be as much as 40%. So when people talk about, oh, there are too many Africans, and they're all so poor and their countries can't support them and so on, actually a large number of African countries, if you look at them, are quite relatively underpopulated, given the potential of their land. It's just that potential has not been realised. Mm. It's not the fact that they're having too many kids. That's the problem. And you need to invert the telescope and say you need to, you know, pursue good governance and development and so on. And that's, it's, I'll be honest, you know, seriously lacking in large parts of the continent. I'm not, you know, starry-eyed about it. But I think in about 20 years or so, we'll see Africa really beginning to really show its full potential, I would say, if I had to hazard a timeline. And I think in the medium and long term, its demographic dividend will be the thing that really makes Africa the continent of the future.
It's been a fascinating conversation, Zainab. So thank you so much for the time. And thank you for the book as well, as I say, filling a huge gap in my own knowledge.
Thank you so much, Will, for this wonderful conversation. Thank you for taking the time.